Blog Talk Radio.
Start it.
Johnny on the track.
Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team fucking here. Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team here, nigga. Started from the bottom, now we.
That is right. That is right. You start from the bottom, but now we're here. It's Monday. Hope everybody had a good weekend. Thank you guys for tuning in to Inside the Octagon. I am one of your hosts, Kalani Lua, along with my main man, Leo Showers. Leo, what's going on, brother?
Hey, what's going on, brother? Good to hear from you. And, man, another international fight week in the books, and it was a memorable one for both good and bad reasons. So can't wait to get into it.
Man, oh, man, and let's get into it right away. You're right. International Fight Week, you know, has become a thing of tradition here in Las Vegas for the UFC. Generally, you know, the first week and a half of July, UFC likes to do it big. This year, though, a lot different than what we're used to. And really, let's start with UFC 213, the creme de la creme, so to speak. What was supposed to be the main event ended up not being the main event. UFC bantamweight champion Amanda Nunes pulls out of her scheduled title fight against number one contender Valentina Shevchenko. According to Dana White, she was cleared by doctors both Friday and Saturday, but both days Nunes was saying that she wasn't feeling good and she ended up just wasn't ready to fight. Leo, we've had a couple days to let this soak in now. What do you make of what happened with the original schedule plan of the main event of Nunes and Shevchenko?
Man, it's really sad. Like we've been talking about over the last few weeks, this International Fight Week event has been kind of developing a bit of a curse where all these events are falling through at the last minute. And, man, how last minute of Amanda Nunes to just pull out the day of the pay-per-view. There's really nothing the company can do in terms of replacement. And basically the fans are just kind of, sat with their hands with no main event championship fight. I feel bad for Nunes that all the information just came out and now everybody just throwing her under the bus saying that she was cleared to fight. And apparently this sinus infection is kind of a thing for her. She's had to deal with it before, but this time around she just did not feel like her head was in it, and she had to pull out at the last minute.
Yeah, her head literally wasn't in it with the sinus infection. And there was even an interview, I don't know if you saw it, Leo, but there's an interview, I believe, before or after the Rousey fight where she talked about she needed to come to Vegas 2 weeks ahead of time to get acclimated to the weather. And she's coming from Florida. Here in Vegas, we're about half a mile to a mile above Florida sea level. The air is very dry out here. So for people who are not used to it, it definitely will affect you in that manner. And look, there will be people who say she should have just taken some antibiotics or this and that, and been good to go. Hey, I can't just call in sick on my days of work, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but you're not getting punched in the face at your job now, are you? So, in hearing this news, I'm definitely, at first, you know, just like you, I was disappointed. But in hearing it, I'm like, you know what? I'm actually glad she did it, because if she would have went out there, and let's just say she couldn't get her breathing down correctly, and she gets done up by Valentina Shevchenko, which, given her striking ability, not to take anything away, but that could have been a very serious possibility. We're talking about potential injuries, losing your title, and then having that highlight of you going out there getting beat down because you were trying to, quote-unquote, toughen it out. Leo, if you were in Nunez's corner, would you have stuck with the same advice of telling her not to go through with it? Or, in your personal opinion, do you think you would have maybe tried to push her towards, hey, champ, come on, you know, you're the champ, you're the one that wins, that people work
with. Sorry, I thought I lost you there.
Brother, here, man.
Okay, so I think we're cutting out a little bit, but I'm going to try this. So, I think it all falls on the fact that Nunes is already a champion. I think if she were a contender, it would be a lot easier for her to just put her chin down and try to go in there and try to win that title. But she's already a champion. She's got a whole lot to lose by going in there and losing in spectacular fashion. You know, like you said, those highlights, they linger out there for a very long time. And you know, this sport is a very what have you done for me lately type of atmosphere. So, like you say, if she loses in devastating fashion, it's really hard to come back from something like that. So you really can't blame Amanda for pulling out. And, you know, as far as, you know, the breeding goes, and like you said, this is a very dry climate here in Las Vegas. And, you know, those sinus infections, they get really dry in your nose, and breathing becomes next to impossible. So, I mean, I've had to deal with that before, and I've never had to go in there and fight against a highly trained opponent. So, yeah, I really can't blame Amanda Nunes. Like I said, it's really unfortunate that the information that she was cleared came out to the public, because now everybody's accusing her of cowering out of a fight. That, I mean, she won the fight against Valentina Shevchenko, so I don't think she's necessarily scared of her opponent. It's just, you know, why are you going to go in there and fight with already a big deficit on your side?
Yeah, the information coming out, I didn't like, especially when it doesn't come out with the other side of the story. And this is the same thing with when you fail a drug test. So-and-so's been flagged, but we're not getting the other side as well. What are they being flagged for? Is it a steroid? Is it a tainted supplement? And then, you know, you get someone like Yoel Romero or even Chris Cyborg, fail a drug test, but it wasn't actually a failed drug test because they were cheating. Yoel Romero, who we'll get to in a moment, had a tainted supplement. Cyborg had a prescription from her doctors. But because the narrative of they're being fired by USADA comes out there, the narrative is, oh, these are steroid users, these are cheaters, et cetera, et cetera. So the information about her coming out and being cleared to fight, that definitely, like you said, does put a black eye on her reputation as a fighter, because this was a woman who was being billed as a rainmaker. You know, it was one of the powerful hitters in the division, one of the best all-around fighters, somebody who could potentially be a long-reigning champion, try to break Ronda Rousey's record, maybe to 410 for that title, make history. And then this comes out. It was very unfortunate that we couldn't see this this rematch, and we couldn't see Nunes and Shevchenko do battle to settle their scores once again. Now, Dana White said in a press conference, because of this, he's not going to put Amanda Nunes in the main event anymore. This same woman who stepped up on 2 days' notice at UFC 200 to be the main event, same woman who main evented 207 against Ronda Rousey, who you guys gave all the promotion to, and she KOs her in less than 50 seconds. Is this fair for Dana White in the UFC, who we know Dana's an emotional guy? Is it fair for them to hold this type of a grudge against Amanda Nunes, or after a couple of days, time has gone by, time heals all wounds, will cooler heads prevail, and maybe she will be back in the main event picture?
Well, like you say, Dana White is a very emotional guy, and this is not the first time we've heard Dana say, you know, so-and-so is not going to be in the main event anymore, John Jones being the prime example of that. You know, they've built a spectacular card around John Jones, you know, just months after Dana White saying that he'll never be in that position again. So I don't know if I believe Dana that Amanda Nunes will never be a main event fighter again. I think, you know, especially in a year like this, when you really need fighters with recognition, and I think Amanda's slowly becoming that despite the lack of promotion, when you need big main event names, I think you have to play with the cards that you're dealt. And sooner or later, I don't see why Amanda Nunes will not be in a main event slot. You know, granted, maybe this, you know, they're already talking about putting her up in the September card in Canada at 215, maybe that's not going to be a main event slot for her. But years down the line, if Amanda keeps defending her title and she becomes a, you know, a dominant female champion, you kind of have to put her in a headlining role.
Leo, and you know what? Great point. You know, you're absolutely right. I didn't even think about that. Dana White says John Jones won't be in the main event again. Voila. And in the month, what do we have? 214, DC versus Jones. So great point by you. Leo, I want to ask you this, because I was listening to some radio interviews today, and I was listening to some other people talk. And, you know, the narrative is fighters never fight at 100%. You know, you take a look at someone like Donald Cerrone, pulls his groin, has a staph infection, still wants to fight Robbie Lawler, but it gets pushed back 2 weeks, but still wants to go out there and fight regardless. You got someone like Conor McGregor, doesn't tell you that he's torn up his knee ahead of two fights, goes out there against Chad Mendes, still fight, even though he needs surgery afterwards. Keeps it on the low. But then you got this issue here. You even got Cain Velasquez pulled out of fights. Is there a line on where we should judge a fighter's quote-unquote toughness for getting in there and fighting through injuries? Or is it always going to be a case-by-case scenario? Where do you fall in that argument?
Well, you brought up Donald Cerrone. I think he's one of the prime examples of this guy who's just absolutely too tough for his own good. You know, word out there was that he was dealing with a staph infection, that he wanted to fight, you know, what, 2-3 weeks after that. That's just not a smart thing to do, especially against a guy like Robbie Lawler. Luckily, as Dana said in his press conference scrum, he had to step in there and tell Cowboy that, no, we're just going to rebook you for a few weeks later, which I think is a smart thing to do. Like I said, it's always a different scenario depending on whether or not you're already a champion or not. Like in the case of Conor McGregor, he was going in there fighting for a championship fight, and he already had an opponent drop out on him. So, I mean, his hands were basically tied. I mean, kudos to Conor McGregor for going in there with as word has it, it was a torn ACL. But like I said, he was not a champion at that time. So, you know, I think you have a bit more to lose when you have a championship around your waist, and that's not something you want to go in there and lose because of something that it's just out of your control.
Yeah, and this narrative that, you know, we want to label Nunez a certain way, I think is one, it not only is it unfair, but I also think it's pretty ignorant considering that she's already fought Shevchenko before. Now, granted, maybe after that fight, maybe she kind of realized that, okay, this girl's going to be a lot tougher than what I initially thought. But still, Nunez has been in there with the top best of the best in her division and has never backed down. So, you know, it's unfortunate.
Yeah,
it
was interesting. Amanda Nunez came out, I think it was this past week, that she said that was the first time when she fought against Shevchenko the first time, that was the first time she ever fought a southpaw. And she hasn't fought one since. She's only had two fights since then. So that's why she said she was a little bit rattled towards the end of that fight. I mean, in the first two rounds, there was a lot of grappling, and Amanda Nunes dominated the majority of that fight. And then the fight just kind of turned on her, and, you know, once it became more of a stand-up battle, Shevchenko started picking her spots, and she really did a very good comeback. Now, Amanda says that she's been working solely on southpaw since this rematch was announced, so... Yeah, as far as people saying that she was scared to pull out, I mean, how are you scared to pull out against an opponent that you already beat? And you already beat pretty convincingly. So I don't see where people are coming from. It's just an unfortunate situation for Amanda Nunes, an unfortunate situation for Shevchenko as well, but it's something that you really can't help. I mean, it's just something that happened.
It's the social media age of instant negativity. Let's just find something to be angry about and something to bash somebody else about, especially all these quote-unquote experts who are either medical experts or fighter experts because they're fighters themselves who say, oh, you could have went in there and fought anyways. You know, this. Yeah. When you do it yourself, kudos to you, man. But nonetheless, that fight happened somewhere down the road, and what was interesting was, just on a couple of hours' notice, UFC strawweight champion Joanna Jędrzejczyk, she was pleading, begging with the UFC to let her step in and fight Valentina Shevchenko. But apparently the reason that she couldn't do it was not only because of all the testing, but the main one was the Nevada State Athletic Commission wouldn't get the results back for a pregnancy test in time to clear her for a fight. Leo? Granted, both of us, I'm sure, wish that we were on the other side of that pregnancy test to say, is it mine? But outside of being dirty, filthy pigs, what do you make of the 115-pound champion willing to step up 20 pounds with no camp on a couple of hours' notice and find the number one contender out there? What do you make of that?
I mean, talk about the female version of Adama Cerrone. I mean, how absolutely insane Jędrzejczyk to go in there and volunteer to step in on a fight, you know, with a couple hours notice. I mean, she probably just got off the couch and said, hey, you know, put me in there. Absolutely. I can't say how much I admire Jędrzejczyk's heart and her determination to go in there and try to save a fight, a pay-per-view. And that would have been a really interesting fight to see. A lot of people don't know that these two women, Shevchenko and Jędrzejczyk, they already have history between each other. I think Shevchenko's 3-0 against her in Muay Thai fighting. So, but I mean, this is a MMA. It's a completely different game. So I think regardless of this fight not happening this past weekend, I think there might be a possibility that these two women might face each other, perhaps in the 125 division that's yet to be inaugurated, or maybe at 135 since Jędrzejczyk has already volunteered to step up that much. So really good PR move by Jędrzejczyk. So unfortunately, you know, a couple hours notice is not enough for the commission to go through all the tests and try to license somebody to rescue a main event. So we were stuck without a women's championship fight that night.
It is very unfortunate. For Joanna, you know, she did do an interview where she said, you know, it wasn't about winning or losing. That doesn't matter to her, but she's a fighter. You know, she's a throwback fighter. She might be petite as far as figure size. You know, she's not the Amanda Nunes or Cyborg or Ronda Rousey, you know, with the muscular physique and whatnot. But she is very much a game warrior, just as anybody else, as you said, the female version of Donald Cerrone. She's got that Conor McGregor mentality. Anytime, anywhere, any place, it doesn't matter. So kudos to her for being willing to step up. Now, you're saying this, and I'm not trying to fact check you here. I don't see where Joanna and Shevchenko had any Muay Thai matches against each other. I know that was out there. Now, I know Joanna faced Karolina Kowalkiewicz back in the day before she beat her. Now, obviously, with Muay Thai, maybe the records aren't fully here, but just from what I'm seeing on her list, I don't see it. But as you said, if they, you know, with that little bit of history, that'd be a great buildup if they ever do meet somewhere in the future. I find it interesting that she would want to jump up to 135 instead of waiting till 125 division opens up. 10-pound difference, you know, not so much. We'll see where Joanna decides to go. Maybe she'll try to go for all three belts at one point in her career to really cement herself as the baddest female fighter of all time. That's going to be interesting.
So just for clarity's sake, she beat Valentina Shevchenko, beat Joanna by decision in amateur Muay Thai once in 2006, again by decision in 2007, and again by decision in 2008. So they have faced each other plenty of times before. But like I say, completely different form of striking here in MMA with the takedowns involved and the clinching. And, you know, it's just a completely different game.
Okay, well, you know what? I guess your Google research is much better than mine, I suppose. I'll submit to you on that. I want to say, okay, you're right in that regard. But, yeah, I would definitely love to see those two take on each other somewhere in the future. And, plus, I like to see what Joanna looks like at 135 with the added weight. With her striking, would her power be increased to where maybe she's getting more knockdowns and finishes? Or taking on the bigger females, would it not be as effective and maybe she had to be more technical and more lucid in her fighting style? We'll see how that goes. Speaking of what we did see go, the main event of UFC 213 ended up being a pretty damn good matchup. Robert Whittaker, the fighter from down under, the Aussie, defeats Yoel Romero, handing the former Olympic silver medalist his first loss inside the UFC. Unanimous decision. Whittaker now the UFC interim middleweight champion. Before we get to what happened afterwards, what do you think about this 5-round back and forth battle? Hell of a fight by both men. Hell of a show of heart and determination. But Whittaker ended up being the one to get his hands raised at the end. What did you make of Whittaker versus Romero?
Yeah, I was absolutely floored by Robert Whittaker's game plan going in. I mean, it turns out he didn't even follow his game plan because early on in the fight, Yoel Romero sidekicks him in the knee, hyperextends it, and then he severely injured his knee. Who knows how long Robert Whittaker is going to be out. So hopefully it's going to be a quick recovery for him. And he says after that happened, his game plan just kind of went out a little bit. He said he wanted to go in there and kind of spray him with punches and try to pick spots and then take over in the later rounds. That didn't end up happening. Yoel Romero wins the first two rounds pretty convincingly, you know, and then he kind of starts to gas a little bit. And, you know, after the fact, Romero says that was the plan all along, that he wanted to go in there and finish him in the fifth round. How true that is, you know, I don't think any of us know, but Robert Whittaker, what an absolute warrior. He stuck in there and he turned in one hell of a championship performance, and we now have a new interim champion. And we'll see how long before he's facing off against Michael Bisping for the unified title.
I want people to really understand this right here is that Whitaker having a hyperextended knee within the first round and then still did not allow Yoel Romero really to utilize his wrestling. And Romero is one of the best wrestlers in the sport of mixed martial arts, if not the best pure wrestler. And he literally, I mean, he got taken down, I believe, like once or twice, but nothing to where, you know, it wasn't no big slams. It wasn't to where Romero was able to get dominant position on him. And he stuffed a couple takedowns, got a good sprawl in there, backed out of a few. On one leg, this guy was stopping a silver medalist from taking him down. As you said, just goes to show the toughness and the heart of Robert Whittaker, which was truly amazing. And me and you, I pointed this out to you when we were watching the fight. Whittaker utilizing the front kicks to the body, a la Conor McGregor versus Chad Mendes, a very underutilized technique that really isn't, you know, fighters haven't adapted to their game yet, but very, very effective. And we saw, as you said, when we saw Romero start to fade, you notice that every time Whittaker would throw that kick and land it, Romero would take a deep breath afterwards as if to say, good gosh, man, stop it. So I thought it was a tremendous game plan by Whittaker to utilize the front kick and to do that on one leg. I mean, my gosh, man. But give both these guys credit. In that fifth round where it was pretty much 2-2, they went for broke. They were really trying to. If it wasn't for Romero slipping at the end where Whittaker was able to get on top, it very well could have went the other way. consider how close this fight was. Rematch somewhere in the future, or does Romero have to climb back up the ranks, or is he maybe one fight away from taking on the winner of Whittaker and Bisping?
Well, like you said, it was such a close fight. You know, it was 2-2 going into the fifth round. Romero looks to be taking control of the fight, and then, you know, an unfortunate slip by Romero, and then Whittaker, you know, takes full advantage of it and rides out a victory. So, like you said, it was a close enough fight, and it was a very entertaining fight. I can see these two guys going at it once again. Like we said, we don't know the extent of Robert Whittaker's knee injury. He could be out for several months, up to a year. So, you know, why not have Romero step in there and either, you know, have one fight on his way back to the championship or maybe just put him in there against Michael Bisping, given that, you know, the fight against GSP, between GSP and Bisping, that's not going to be happening, according to Dana White. So you got to keep Bisping busy. So you're all Romero. I'm sure that's a guy that'll be happy to step in there.
Now, for all the conspiracy theorists out there, you know, who believe that the UFC fixes fights, the judges are paid off, well, I ask this, Leo. If that is the case from past events, then how come the UFC didn't set up this fight? There was a natural rivalry between Yoel Romero and Michael Bisping. They already been jawing at each other. Bisping, who was sitting cage side behind Romero's corner, rips up a Cuban flag and tosses it up. And now you go to a close decision. If it goes either way, there's really no quote-unquote robbery. But Whitaker's the one that gets his hand raised. Does this further is this further truth of people just love the idea of conspiracies and just want to find any little thing that they can to gravitate to, and there really isn't no quote-unquote fight-fixing in today's era of combat sports?
I think we're, like you've mentioned before, we're living in an era of just instant gratification, and I think it's really easy for people to just want to channel their inner Eddie Bravo, if you will, and just say, everything is fake, nothing I see is real. So, come on, man. I mean, yeah, it would be obvious that Yoel Romero would be the much easier guy to promote in a fight against Bisping. I mean, the rivalry's already there. There's great sound bites. There's great promotion behind a fight between these two guys. It just didn't happen. I mean, Robert Whittaker went in there and spoiled every plan, so now that's the fight that we're going to be getting. So I'm happy that Robert Whittaker is our new interim champion. I think he's a very, very incredible guy to watch. He's very entertaining. His stand-up is just absolutely amazing. So I think he's actually a better, more athletic version of Michael Bisping. So like you said last week, you know, I don't think either one of these guys is a good matchup for Michael Bisping, but man, if you're going in there against a better, stronger, more athletic version of yourself, you know, what can you really do if you're Michael Bisping?
No, and that's very true. And if you are Michael Bisping, maybe you hope that Whitaker's recovery from that hyperextended knee doesn't go as planned, and maybe he's just a tad bit slower on his explosion and his movement, because you're right, Will Whitaker's athletic ability, his toughness, and the power that he's got in his hands, it is going to be tough for Bisping to really stand toe-to-toe with this guy. But, hey, Bisping's a gamer. And we saw even afterwards, you know, Whitaker's not going to be somebody that gives you tremendous sound bites on the mic. But Bisping, you know, it's like he had a premeditated idea of what he wanted to say. Of course, if it was to Yoel Romero, he would have some other things to say. But since it was to Whitaker, it was almost like, hey, I wanted to come in and talk shit, but I really can't. Great fight. And then he goes into talking shit. And like I said, I think that was just in his mind. He just knew, whoever it is, I'm going to let the interim champion know that I'm the real champ. What did you make of Bisping throwing the belt at the feet of Whitaker, saying, I'll see you soon, motherfucker? I mean, Bisping's going to give us some great sound bites, but what did you make of that?
I think it was absolutely marvelous. I mean, how do you build a fight better? I mean, this was a fight that not a whole lot of people were thinking about before this past week, and everybody was talking about Romero and Bisping. So Robert Whitaker wins the fight, spoils all the plans, and Bisping already knows what to say and how to hype the fight. Now I really want to see this fight. I mean, you could see there's no bad blood, there's no disrespect, nothing in there between these two guys, but just give Michael Bisping the microphone and let him go into his promotional mode, and he's going to make a fight happen for you. So genius move by Bisping. I think he's doing himself a very good job as promoting himself. So I'm really happy for him.
Now, definitely, even in the post-fight interview when Whitaker joined the Fox Sports panel, even Bisping was trying to say, hey, come on, let's promote the fight a little bit here. And don't get me wrong, I understand that, you know, I grew up a lifelong wrestling fan. I understand the theatrics of it going into the fight, but at the end of the day, you still got to get in there and knuckle up with each other. And Whitaker's just not going to be that guy. Now, what I find interesting, as you was pointing out to earlier, Leo, with Whitaker's knee injury, now this kind of does maybe put on back on the table, well, what if Whitaker is out for, let's say, 6, 7, 9, maybe not months to a year? Do you then entertain GSP versus Bisping? GSP says he wants to do it at Madison Square Garden. Bisping's been on board with it, but, you know, he wants to fight sooner rather than later. If Whitaker is gone for an extended period of time, Leo, do you make GSP Bisping actually happen, or do you go another route?
I think the GSP versus Bisping boat has kind of sailed at this point. Dana White, every time that fight gets brought up, you just kind of see it in his eyes that he's just absolutely embarrassed by everything that went down. I mean, they use their resources to put a press conference and say, this is going to be the fight, and this is what's going to happen. You know, we saw GSP fighting for contract issues for several months before then. It's been a very long, exhausting process. I think at this point, they really just want to get it over with and you know, send George St. Pierre to the division that he was champion in, the championship that he never lost. So I think the fight is going to be him against the winner of Woodley and Maya. And, you know, you're going to have middleweight just kind of go on as it's been going on before George St. Pierre. So, I mean, Luke Rockhold has been very vocal about these guys kind of stepping in there and what he thinks is his place as a, you know, in a championship fight. So I don't think you want to go throw in the GSP boat again. So I said keep GSP at welterweight, and then Romero, Rockhold, Jacare, all these guys, you know, they can go in there and fight for that middleweight championship.
Romero just lost. Jacare just lost. Rockhold lost in his last fight, and he's recovering from injury. Wyman's coming up against Gaslam, but he's riding a losing streak. Whitaker might be out for an extended period of time. I mean, the way we're looking
at it. These are guys who make their living at 185. This is what, you know, what my problem was with the GSP fight in the first place is that this guy has never fought at 185 before, and he's not a current champion at 170, so you can't really bill it as a super fight either. So why give this guy who's never fought at 185 an immediate title shot? I understand if maybe Bisping was going down to 155, I could see it a little more, you know, a la Frankie Edgar. When he lost his championship at 155 to Benson Henderson, he got an immediate title shot against Jose Aldo. I don't mind seeing that. But if you're going up a weight class to a weight class that you've never fought in before, you've been out for so long, you know, there's that title that you never lost lingering out there, and a guy who's calling you out, willing to fight you, go down to 170 and fight fight for that title. If you want to fight Bisping after that, if you're a champion, by all means, that's a super fight, and that's something that you can absolutely build as a champion versus champion. That's a real fight.
Well, as I was trying to allude to, with the guys either being currently injured or coming off losing streaks, there's not many options for who Bisping is going to fight if Whitaker's out for an extended period of time. Romero Jacare just come off losses. Weidman's going up against Gastelum. If Weidman wins that one, well, he's what? He's 1-3 in his last four. You got Rockhold. He lost to Bisping, and he's coming off an injury. We don't know when exactly he's going to be due back. Outside of that, you might
Kelvin,
say,
Kelvin Gastelum lingering out there as well.
You no, but I'm saying, you know, of course he's got that, but excuse me. But again, you know, how far do you move Gastelum up the totem pole if he gives Weidman his four straight loss? Anderson Silva's out there, sure, okay. But, you know, you kind of look at it and say, well, guys might be stuck in the mud, but there's really not a clear logjam at the front of guys who are deserving of title shots right away. Some of you guys need to win a fight or two before getting back into it. And, Leo, I ask you this. Can you name any champion who went to another weight division and did not get a title shot immediately? The only one I could think of is Anderson Silva when he went to light heavyweight. And
yep.
I think, yeah, that's the only one I could think of. Everyone else, look, Randy Couture got an immediate title shot at heavyweight when he went. Now, granted, he fought there before, but he was retired, out for a full year. He comes back, takes on Tim Sylvia. Now, I get it. He fought a heavyweight before, but still, if you're a champion going to another division, you know, outside of maybe just doing it just because, I would say why not? I don't want GSP taking on multiple guys at middleweight. If he's going to go there, there's only two guys that he needs to fight, Anderson Silva or whoever holds the title, and it just so happened to be Michael Bisping. So I would say why not? You know, if he can make 185, those are the only two guys at middleweight that he deserves to fight. Do I want to see GSP and Yoel Romero and Jacare and Rockhold before he gets – no, I don't want to see all that. I want to see Anderson Silva or the whoever the middleweight champion is, which happens to be Michael Bisping right now, if that's GSP. Now, I do agree. You got Woodley calling out, but just as we've seen in the past couple of years, Leo, who's the bigger fight, GSP and Woodley or GSP and Bisping? It's GSP and Bisping without a doubt. So, excuse me. So I definitely could see why the UFC went there. But as we have said, the boat is sailed on that. Potentially, we'll see. I won't be mad, though, if they try to revisit that if Whitaker is out for a long period of time. But before we get to that, I do hope Whitaker is not out for a long period of time. I hope that he could fight potentially by the end of this year. I would love to see Whitaker and Bisping go at it to settle and unify the titles. I think it'd be a good one. Now, for the other guy in this scenario, Yoel Romero, first loss in the UFC, very close decision. What do you do with him? Who should you line him up with next to where if he gets a win, does he jump right back in the title picture or does he need one, two, maybe three wins to get back up there? What do you do with Yoel Romero, Leo?
I think you always kind of have to strike when the iron's hot, and it's always hard to say, okay, you know, so-and-so with one win can jump in there with a championship fight. Well, it also depends on how good you look in that win. I think if you look spectacular in one win against a top-ranked opponent, then it makes a whole lot of sense to go in there and challenge once again for the title. But, you know, if you just go in there and ride out a split decision against, you know, the number seven guy or something like that, then maybe the road for you is a little bit longer. I think there was a funky victory in Yoel Romero's career against Jacare Souza. I think Jacare won that fight. And, you know, both of these guys are coming off a loss against the same guy, so it would make a lot of sense for these two to face each other. I think it would, like I said, it would be a bit tougher for Jacare to go in there and challenge for a title, but if Yoel Romero goes in there and handles business against, one of the top five guys in the world, you just have to springboard him back up there. You know, Rockhold's been clamoring for a championship fight as well, so I wouldn't mind seeing that fight between Rockhold and Romero, so... Hey, you know, just give him a top-ranked opponent and see how he looks. You know, depending on his performance, then you grant him a title shot.
You took the words right out of my mouth. The Jacare rematch is one that I was so hoped that they are able to book and put against each other. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I believe Jacare might be dealing with a pec injury right now. I'm not, I believe I thought I read that before. I could be wrong, but I would love to see Yoel Romero and Jacare too, because you're right. The first time they fought each other, because of the fence grab by Yoel Romero, that really did change the tide for that fight and really propelled Romero to get the victory over Jacare, because at the end he was able to hold ground position on top of him. So I would love to see these two fight each other and go at it once again. And I would say, you know, because they both have one loss recently and the win streak they've been on, I would say the winner of that could potentially jump right back into the number one contenders bout, or maybe the winner of that takes on Luke Rockhold if he's healthy enough to come back. Maybe those two, and maybe we could settle it between those three. So I definitely would love to see that rematch happen in the near future if possible.
Well, I think the problem for Jacare is that his most recent loss was against Robert Whittaker, and it was in devastating fashion. Robert Whittaker just gave him a seminar in striking and in grappling. I mean, he handled him just in all facets of MMA. So, you know, if Robert Whittaker is a champion, you know, come the end of the year, and Romero and Jacare are vying for a championship, I think it's going to be a little bit harder for Jacare. But like I say, I mean, you strike when the iron's hot. If Jacare goes in there and demolishes Yoel Romero, then I think you have a bit of a better case for Jacare.
Well, see, that's the thing. If Jacare is able to get an impressive victory over Romero, and then, yeah, you know, you could write it and say, hey, you know what? Even though I did get my ass kicked the first time, hey, you caught me off guard. I wasn't expecting it, maybe. I was injured. I was sick. Mm-hmm. I had a sinus infection. Whatever the case may be, there is something to build off of that. And you're right. He did get done up the first time. But who knows? Maybe in a rematch, it'll be a little bit different story. And we'll see if the alligator can clinch his grip and go from there. But it's definitely going to be interesting to see how the middleweight picture falls out with Whitaker's injury and then down the ladder from that. We'll talk more about middleweight running the show. In a very lackluster co-main event, we don't have to spend that much time on it. Overeem defeats Verdum in a whatever performance. This matchup had both fighters, you know, it's a trilogy that's been going on for 10 years. Both fighters were talking about going into this wanting to get a title shot after the victory. But with this performance, it wasn't going to happen. Why did Verdum take Overeem to the ground when he seemed to have him defeated on the feet? What did you make of this co-main event between the two former Strikeforce fighters?
Yeah, I think that was a very bad mistake by Verdum to take Overeem down. When he had him on his heels, he had him up against the cage, you know, he had him rattled. You know, I don't think Overeem's head was really, really in there. So maybe Verdum thought that he would go to his bread and butter and try to take down Overeem and go for a submission or maybe a TKO on the ground. But that didn't work out. Overeem was able to hold on. He won the first two semi-boring rounds, so that was enough for him to score a victory. It's too bad for Verdum because he won the most entertaining round of a somewhat boring fight. So, like I said, it was just probably bad idea to take down Overeem at the end of the round there when he had him, you know, very, very close to a possible knockout. So, you know, after the fact, Overeem was talking about he didn't really want to go for too much, a home run punch and risk getting knocked out himself by Verdum. You know, we've seen Overeem have a testy chin over the last few years, so maybe he just doesn't want to risk too much, but it seemed like his game plan was very tentative. Like, both guys, really, they were very tentative in the first two rounds, but Overeem was just kind of sitting there hoping for maybe a one-punch knockout that just never came because he never really threw it.
You bring up a good point. I want to ask you this. With Overeem, this is one of the most feared and most well-rounded strikers in UFC history, especially in the heavyweight division. Punches, kicks, knees, elbows, a former K-1 Grand Prix champion. That is no joke whatsoever. But he does seem to be very tentative with being aggressive in his fights often at times. Do you think it's a testament to his chin being rocked in recent years, so he's trying to be more cautious and protected, or do you think because he's been training with Greg Jackson down there at Jackson MMA, do you think it's kind of just he's fallen into the typical Greg Jackson style of fighter? Win off points, be safe, don't go for anything risky, just play it close to the chest. What do you think? Do you think it's the trainers or do you think it's his chin? Why is Alistair Overeem not being as aggressive as he should be given his skill set in a stand-up game?
Well, what's crazy is that Overeem went out there, and I don't know if you noticed, but he had his hands down the whole time, and he had a very wide stance. So it's pretty clear that he was going in there trying to defend takedowns against Verdum, and Verdum was just not really going for too many takedowns. I think Overeem stuffed, you know, two or three in the whole fight, but Verdum's hands were down, or rather, Overeem's hands were down the whole time. So maybe there's not much in terms of him fearing getting knocked out, even though that's been the case over the last few years. But, you know, Verdum was really not there to capitalize on that anyway. So I think it's more the latter of your point, is that he did move on to Greg Jackson's camp, and I think they try to turn him into more of a complete mixed martial artist. He used to be this, you know, devastating knockout artist with a devastating guillotine choke if you shot on him. But he just seemed like he was waiting to pick spots, and there was just no spots for there for him. If you look at the statistics, which are, you know, really pitiful, it was like 7 or 8 strikes thrown in the whole fight by Overeem, and yet he still wins the fight. You know, I mean, actually the statistics are on Verdum's side, but, you know, because we have this 10-8 round system in MMA, Verdum wins two boring rounds, and then Overeem wins two boring rounds, and Verdum wins an exciting round, but the fight goes to Overeem. So.
Yeah, it was unfortunate, and you know, Overeem did admit afterwards that he probably realizes that because of that performance, he probably won't be in line for a title shot next. He probably have to go out there and get another victory before that can happen. Considering that, Leo, what would be more important, gaining the victory or going out there and trying to earn your title shot? Because, of course, you want to win. That is most important. You do want to win. But if you know that a win here, an impressive win, could lead to a title shot, wouldn't you want to go out there and put more on the line as opposed to playing in low key? And I was just mind-boggled by that, because I'm thinking, if you want a title shot, you need to go out there and put an exclamation point on why you should jump the line of who's next, you know, Francis Ngannou and JDS or whatever, and go out there and get in line. But they didn't do that. Can you help me understand, why would you want to win boringly when, if you would have won excitingly, you potentially could be next in line for a title shot?
Well, there was a really interesting quote. I think it was by Ryan Bader a few months ago, soon after he signed with Bellator. I think it was a stipulation in his contract that he just gets paid a set amount for fighting. He doesn't get paid show and win money. He just gets paid what he's going to get paid. And Bader had something very interesting to say, in that now I don't really have to, you know, point fight in MMA. Now I can just go in there and fight, and if it looks good, that's great. If it looks bad, then that's just, you know, then that's too bad. Maybe I didn't do enough in my camp. But in the UFC, this is still going on, where these guys are getting show and win money. And the most important thing is, you know, if you lose, you're going to lose half your money. So you better win boring and get all your money, as opposed to, you know, try and go in there for a knockout and then get knocked out yourself. And that knocks you down a few pegs on the title ladder. So you really can't blame the guys for going in there with a conservative game plan. That's just how the game has kind of brought him up to this point.
As a paying customer, I can complain as much as I damn well choose to. This is America, God damn it! But I do understand what you're saying. I completely agree. And I remember Matt Mitrione even brought that up and said he believes that's something the UFC needs to take out of their pay structure, is just have a set pay and not have the win bonuses, because at the win bonuses, guys aren't trying to put on exciting matches. They're just trying to make sure they win, as opposed to, if we're getting paid a set amount, then, like you just said with Ryan Bader, I don't have to worry about wins and losses. I'm getting paid X amount. Let's go out there and knuckle up. So I would love it if the UFC got their act together and chose to go that route. And maybe if they did that, maybe we would see more exciting fights going forward, as opposed to the safe safe route that a lot of these fighters take. Now, speaking of safe routes, what did you make of former UFC lightweight champion Anthony Pettis' victory over Jim Miller? Pettis making his way back to the lightweight division after an unsuccessful try at featherweight. Looked pretty good physically. got a good victory over a veteran opponent. What did you make of Showtime back in the lightweight division? Is he back to climbing the ladder, or has he still got ways to go?
No, I think Pettis went in there and looked like Pettis. I think he answered the grappler question. You know, Jim Miller is one of the best grapplers in the world, and you know Pettis was fighting off his back very well. You know, his offensive jiu-jitsu is very impressive. You know, I don't think you're going to be catching Jim Miller with anything like that. But the fact that he went in there and he looked very credible against a good grappler, and that's been Anthony Pettis' knock his whole career at 155, is that he can't hang with some of the best grapplers. And I think he went in there with a very good game plan. He looked very good. Unfortunately, broke his hand, and there's word out there that he might have require surgery this time around. But I think, like I said last week, there's a road for Anthony Pettis to climb his way back up at 155, and I see this as a very, very good first step in his new journey at 155.
Yeah, it was very good to see Pettis get back not only in a win column, but do it in a pretty impressive manner. Like you said, Jim Miller, he's not a slouch whatsoever. He may not be one of the elite guys, but he's certainly somebody that you got to take very seriously, because you know you're going to be in for a hell of a fight each and every time he steps in the cage. So it was good to see Pettis answer those questions. He did say that he recommitted himself to the weight room for this fight. He never really did it beforehand. It was kind of just like, okay, but he really wanted to put an emphasis on that. So it was good in that route to see him there. Now, he does have to recover from his hand injury. We don't know how long that's going to be, but there's some pretty good matchups for him at lightweight. You got Ali Aquinta, Michael Chiesa, Michael Johnson, who we'll obviously talk about later, Dustin Poirier, Kevin Lee, obviously Nate Diaz. I think it'll be a tremendous matchup if Diaz and Pettis went at it. But I wanted to throw this out there on the air with you, Leo. We talked about it a little bit during the fights, but should Pettis ever consider moving up to welterweight? You look at Donald Cerrone, you look at RDA, guys who moved up, and so far it's worked well for them. Now, I know Cerrone is like 6 foot, so it makes more sense physically from a physical stature point, but RDA is about the same height as Pettis, if not just a tad bit shorter. Pettis, who walks around at a very heavy weight for a lightweight, should Anthony Pettis ever consider trying to make a run at welterweight, especially considering welterweight is tough, but it's not a meat grinder like the lightweight division. I mean, lightweight, 1 through 12, you're taking on somebody who might be a title contender with a couple of wins. Welterweight kind of tapers off after a few fighters. Should Showtime ever try his luck at the heavier weight class?
I think Showtime, you know, he made a name at 155, and he's made a career at 155. I think he should try to stick to his guns and go for a title run there. Now, if the train derails again for some reason, then, you know, maybe the weight cutting is just too much for him, then welterweight might be a possibility. You know, as far as height-wise, look at Kelvin Gastelum. He's like 5'9", fighting at 185. So, and he's doing very good at that weight. So, that's not always, the be-all, end-all. You know, we talked about George Roop this past weekend. You know, that guy's like 6'1", fighting against 135ers. You know, he looks like death on the scale, but, you know, and he's like a middle-of-the-pack bantamweight. So he's not a world beater out there either. So, I think, with a guy like Anthony Pettis, you know, with his skill set, I think, height just kind of becomes irrelevant at some point. And, if he were to move up to welterweight, I think, you know, he'd want to use speed and, you know, that weird flashy style that he uses all the time to, you know, confuse opponents and try to regain that Showtime Pettis that he was at one point. But, like I said, I really want to see him try to stick at 155. I think there's a roadmap for him at 155 for another championship. It's just a matter of, if he can rack up some wins.
Now, I mean, obviously him being a former champion at lightweight, you know, it certainly is not unseen that he can't make another run for the title. But I would love to see not only potential matchups, especially if one guy from Canada decides to finally come back into the cage, I wouldn't mind seeing future matchups at welterweight. You know, as we get more and more into understanding the effects of weight cutting, and we're seeing how some fighters just destroy themselves physically to try to make a certain weight, I would definitely love to see more weight classes to where these fighters can fight closer to their natural weight. You know, and yeah, who knows? if Pettis can get back on a winning streak and build up some wins, hey, it's very possible that lightweight could just be where he needs to stay at. But I also think if he struggles a little bit, or if there's just one or two matchups at lightweight that just make sense from a fight standpoint, money-wise, I say go for it. We'll see how it all turns out, excuse me, from there. Now, we don't have to talk much about it, but I did want to bring this up just for the nature of who it is. Travis Brown suffered another loss, second round rear naked choke to who did he lose to?
I'm going to try this. Oleksiy Oliniek.
Well, I'm going to go with that. I'm going to say you're better at it than me. So afterwards, Dana White's in the press conference. He thinks Travis Brown should retire. Travis Brown is 2-6 in his last 8 fights and now has lost 4 in a row. 3 of them have come by way of stoppage, TKO, KO, submission choke. He did have a decision against Verdun. But, you know, you're looking at a guy who at one point in time who many thought could be a next challenger for the heavyweight championship. And now, you know, they're talking about he needs to retire. What do you make of Travis Brown? I'm not suggesting that we need to come on here and tell somebody what to do with their career, but what the hell has happened to Hopper Brown?
Yeah, I mean, we were talking very highly about this guy just last week. I thought, you know, he was on the road to a comeback, and you know how heavyweight is. It's always so up and down that, you know, one or two, maybe two or three wins for Brown's case can shoot him up against the Stipe Miocic or whoever the champion is at the time. But this guy hasn't caught any breaks since he's gone on this crazy losing streak. And I don't think it's a physical thing. I think, like Dana White says, his head is just not in it. I don't know exactly where to pinpoint the blame, but Travis Brown is just not in these fights. You know, he's just kind of showing up for a paycheck. And, you know, as we saw in this this past weekend, that rear naked choke that Oliniek had sunk in on him, there was an out. I mean, that wasn't the tightest choke in the world. Like, you know, maybe he tapped to some kind of a jaw crank. Maybe he was just, you know, the squeeze itself was so hard that he just felt that he needed to tap. But there was definitely an out. I mean, his bottom hip was out. There was no hand fighting on his part. There was an out. And he just chose to tap right away. I mean, he just seems like he doesn't have it there mentally anymore. So if that's the case, then I you have to agree with Dana White. If your head is not in it 100%, then you shouldn't be fighting because you're going to go in there and get hurt, and that could be permanent damage down the line.
No, certainly. If you're not in there mentally, and if your mind and heart isn't in it, that's the wrong sport to be half-assing it to. And you just got to wonder, well, what is it that caused you to lose focus? Was it your out of the cage incident that happened with your ex-wife to where that just deterred you, and mentally it just, you're not able to refocus on what you have to do at hand? Is it because of who you're engaged to now and she's such a huge cloud over you that, you know, it's hard to really find your place as a fighter? Is it the new training coaches that you're with Edmund, and they really had just turned everything that was working for you and screwed it all up to where now it's all rusted and expired and mold has grown on it and you just can't clean it? I don't know what it is with Travis Brown, but this guy, like you said, oh my God, man, this guy's 6'7". He's got knockout power. He's got good kicks, strong punches. This could be a guy who could be a future title holder in the division. And now, I mean, he is just losing on the prelims, not looking good for Brownie. Your chances of winning increase 50% because he's the guy. Unfortunately, fall this far. What goes from here as far as whether he decides to retire or continue his career remains to be seen. But, man, whatever, if he chooses to go on, I seriously, seriously, urgently hope he can find his true passion back and get back out there, because regardless of how you may feel about him personally, he was an exciting fighter to watch going forward. Now, speaking of exciting fights and exciting fighters, Friday night we saw the Ultimate Fighter finale, and in the main event we might have saw one of the most exciting fights that we have seen since recent memory, especially at least since Korean Superboy and Cub Swanson. And you want to talk about somebody who's instant action. Justin Gaethje makes his UFC debut a la Terminator style, and with a second-round TKO victory over Michael Johnson in what was an absolute rock'em sock'em war. Leo, what the hell did we witness with Gaethje and Johnson? I mean, my God! I mean, if I could go Jim Ross here, my God! My God! He killed him! What the hell?
I mean, it was a complete and total slobber knocker. I mean, how do you not love a guy like Justin Gaethje? He absolutely went in there and delivered like everybody was expecting him to. I mean, this is a guy that's been doing that in World Series of Fighting, and nobody's been watching. You know, unfortunately, he's 18-0 now, 1-0 in the UFC. You know, so much for UFC bitters. He absolutely went in there and handled business like an absolute warrior. And I mean, how many new fans do you think he's got? How many new Twitter followers do you think he's got? I mean, that must have just gone up tenfold just overnight with such an incredible performance. Finally, we get a fight of the year contender. You know, like it only took 7 months to get there. And I'm a little bit concerned that Justin Gaethje, you know, he does take a lot of punishment, but he does not back down. He's not a quitting guy, and I don't know what you have to do to put that kind of guy away. So whoever's out there next for him, look out, because you're going to go in there and have a war against a maniac.
It was truly something to witness. And, you know, I got to tell you, one thing I do like about Gaethje is he is aware of, considering his fighting style, he's even said, I know I'm going to get knocked out in the UFC. It's just a matter of who's going to be the one to do it. So I do like the idea that, you know, he even though he fights like it, he knows he's not invincible. He knows that he can get clipped. And he got rocked a couple times by Michael Johnson. I mean, Johnson, leading up to it, you know, I hate using this analogy. Oh, they got too emotionally involved in it. I don't think that was the case. But Johnson obviously felt like, because this guy was coming in with so much hype. I mean, even when Johnson entered, this is a guy who was entering the cage who has fought, 16 times in the UFC. He was being booed in favor of somebody who was making their UFC debut. And like you said, this is a fighter who, although he's undefeated and was a champion in another organization, nobody was watching it. This isn't Brock Lesnar or CM Punk coming down here. This is Justin Gaethje. No offense to him, but so I can understand why Johnson kind of felt like he needed to go out there and put on a show, and he almost put the man away. But Gaethje, with his Terminator style, was just absolutely remarkable. Now, there is some talk. Dana White did say that, you know, considering how things might fall out, Gaethje and Ferguson might be a matchup to look forward to in the future. Of course, Ferguson, he's got ties to Khabib Nurmagomedov, maybe Conor McGregor, but that seems like it's on the back burner. Kevin Lee, possibly. If you're the UFC, who do you put in, across from Justin Gaethje? As he said afterwards, who's next? Who would you put next against Gaethje if it was up to you, Leo?
Well, the news came out at some point last week, I think it was, that Conor McGregor wants to go to Russia and face Khabib Nurmagomedov in his home country. And I mean, who in their right mind does not want to see that? Plot of Rocky IV right there. Going to Russia in December, I absolutely want to see that. So unfortunately for Tony Ferguson, he's the guy who's left out. And I think Justin Gaethje and Tony Ferguson, they cut a pretty good promo out there, and they're calling each other out. They both seem to be down with the idea, so I would absolutely love to see that. I mean, how is that for a consolation prize? These two crazy maniacs with crazy styles going out there against each other for a possible, I mean, it's got to be for a number one contender slot. So Tony Ferguson, that's the guy that I'm eyeing for Justin Gaethje next. I don't know that Justin can really withstand the amount of punishment that Tony can dish out, but I mean, can you really put away Justin Gaethje? I mean, it was really tough for Michael Johnson this past weekend. Michael Johnson has a lot of power in his hands. It's documented power. He's got knockouts in his career. So Justin Gaethje, that's just an absolute monster right there. Put him up against Tony Ferguson for a number one contender spot.
Now, certainly, he's got knockout power, but his hands are extremely quick. That on Michael Johnson I'm talking about. But, you know, there is something to be said about that relentless pressure of constantly pushing forward. We see it in boxing with someone like a Gennady Golovkin, and now we're seeing it with Justin Gaethje. When someone is constantly pressing forward and forcing you to retreat, granted, you could do a Chuck Liddell or an Anderson Silva, circle, 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 counter, and tag them apart, but there's very few guys who can hold up their own under that amount of pressure, because as we were watching, Gaethje's going to throw heavy leg kicks. So eventually, if you can't put them away fast enough, your legs are going to start to tire and be heavier and sore from the leg kick. So now your mobility is hampered. Now with that, now you're pushing even harder to move around with the constant pressure of him coming forward. That's wearing on your gas tank. Then he's hitting you, and then you're trying to throw everything you can at him. Next thing you know, you're huffing and puffing for air, and Gaethje is just like a terminator. He just keeps coming and coming and coming. So, yeah, if he takes on somebody like Ferguson, Ferguson's unique style of fighting and his offensive output with striking and grappling, it would definitely be something I would love to see against Gaethje, to see can Gaethje adjust to it, or will Ferguson just eat him up. I would also wouldn't mind seeing maybe him and Kevin Lee, Gaethje and Nate Diaz, hell, Gaethje and Pettis, you know, obviously if Pettis is healthy enough, but Gaethje right now, according to the rankings, he's already number six because Johnson was five, so Gaethje already at number six. You know, hey, one more victory, yeah, he might be in line for a title shot sooner rather than later if he can keep the win streak going. So, man, it is going to be exciting to watch Justin Gaethje in the future and to see what he can do. Now, the Ultimate Fighter finale. You know,
just one more word. Just one more word about Justin Gaethje. I think, you know, if he really wants to do wonders for his career, all he needs is really head movement. So go down there to Glendale Fight Club and get some tips from Edmund Tavarian. I think he's going to absolutely take his game to the next level. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, without a doubt, he would teach you head movement. And you've seen what happened to the fighters when they go down there. They are world beaters, or more like they get beat by the world. But no, you're absolutely right.
I'm the real. I wish Justin Gaethje. I mean, I don't know how much more development he can make to his game. I mean, he's a young guy, but head movement, that's really a critical hole in his game right now. I think he's taking too much punishment. So. Against the top 2-3 guys in the division, I don't know that would be a smart idea to go in there and take that much punishment. So maybe work a little bit on head movement, and if he does that, then I mean, who really can stop a guy like that?
Yeah, I mean, the way he covers up when you're attacking him, he just stands there and kind of just bends over, puts his hands up to his face, tucks his chin, and bends over. Which, yeah, that's going to leave you open for takedowns, leg kicks, and uppercuts like Michael Johnson was landing. But, yeah, you're right. If he just adds in the head movement with that, you know, he might be able to last a little bit longer against some of the elite guys in the division. So we'll see what Gaethje decides to do. But, hey, it's got him this record so far, and it's got him this far. I don't think he's looking at changing it just yet. Speaking of changing, this could be the last thing we talk about for the finale is, the Ultimate Fighter finally crowned Jesse Taylor as he picked up a submission victory in the second round over Diego Lima. And Taylor has one of the most remarkable stories. Here's a guy who is now closer to mid-30, but close to 10 years ago was in the finale for the Ultimate Fighter when it was Rampage and Forrest Griffin. I believe that was Ultimate Fighter Season 7. Had a chance to be in the final, but because he made some errors outside of the cage at one of the Las Vegas hotels and casinos after a night of partying, gets kicked off, gets pulled from the finale, doesn't get a chance to the UFC, and really had to find his way outside the cage, reinvented himself. Now, he does have 15 losses, 14 of those coming via submission, but he is an absolute throwback style of fighter, pure wrestler. As I said in the fight, he looked like Mark Coleman Jr. or Mark Coleman's mini-me with the bald head, the ears, the husky figure, but then also his fighting style. Leo, this was called the Ultimate Fighter Redemption. Was there any perfect title or any perfect winner for this season other than Jesse Taylor winning the Ultimate Fighter finale, the Redemption series?
No, you're absolutely right. Redemption, a perfect name for a story like the one of Jesse Taylor. I mean, what can you say about this guy? 10 years later, I mean, he really messed up in the Ultimate Fighter finale 10 years ago, and we really haven't seen or heard from him since. We thought he was just absolutely gone from the UFC forever, and then all of a sudden we see him in this redemption season, and he goes in there and submits everybody, including the finale. So he looked pretty damn good, and he delivers one hell of a speech after that. You know, what an inspiring guy. How do you not look up to this guy? You know, you couldn't help but really just feel for him, at the sight of him looking at that $290,000 check. You know, that's got to be life-changing money for him. And now he gets another shot, or really his first shot ever now at the UFC. So good on him. I'm really happy for the guy, and I can't wait to see what comes next for him.
Now, certainly indeed. Now, given his age and, you know, he's got a very good skill set, but he is limited to a degree. We saw Lima drop him in the second round when they met in the middle of the ring with a left, but Lima rushed him, just was able to utilize his wrestling. His stand-up isn't something, you know, it's not, he's, put it like this, Taylor's not going to be in a title shot anytime soon. Or he's going to be a decent fighter. I think he might pick up another win, maybe even two in the UFC, but I don't see his success going as further. Now, this isn't me trying to hate on the guy. Just from looking at what he can do and who and the level of competition he'll face in the UFC, I just don't think he'll be around long enough. But I think it's tremendous that after what he went through before, to come back now as a totally different person and everything's changed and to finally fulfill what he could have did years ago, and who knows where his career could have went then, I definitely think it's awesome. Now, it came later, but it probably came at the right time, because before, when he was a party animal, maybe he would have messed up his opportunity there, which he ended up doing. But if he would have won, maybe he would have still messed it up in the UFC, to whereas now, at least he could enjoy and appreciate the journey he's taken so far going forward. Last thing I wanted to bring up here about the finale, real quick to you, Leo, and this had nothing to do with the fight, but we saw Elias Theodorou and Angela Hill. During their weigh-ins, Angela Hill wanted to wear the Marvel character Black Panther costume mask. If you guys have seen her in Invicta FC, she comes in as different Street Fighter characters, Mortal Kombat characters. She enjoys the spectacle of it, of being a showman at the weigh-ins. Elias Theodorou wanted to show a poster of his that was doing, and the UFC told him, no, you got to wear Reebok. It's got to be our stuff. I can kind of get it for Elias with the poster, because if that's got another company on there, if you're promoting something else, okay. But Angela Hill was wearing a Black Panther mask, which anybody can pick up at the store. That's not really promoting another company that's a competitor to Reebok. Was the UFC too strict on this, or was it fair game considering, hey, that's our policy?
I mean, what is it that we've been kind of fearing that the UFC would turn into after WME bought the company, is that they would kind of become an entertainment company as opposed to a fight promotion company. Well, they have kind of gone the entertainment way, but they're not letting the fighters be entertainers at the same time. Why are they blocking these guys from promoting themselves however they see fit? I mean, Angela Hill, like you say, she's been doing this for a long time in Invicta. A lot of these women dress up for the Wayne's in Invicta, because that's all the Wayans are. It's just entertainment. Why are people going in there and sitting in an arena to watch people weigh on a scale that's not even an actual weigh-in? They want to go in there and be entertained, and they want to get to know the fighters. And Angela Hill is trying to show a side of her that you know the UFC is not really gonna promote. So I don't agree with this decision. I think you know, the UFC can be a little bit more lenient as far as these guys being more themselves at weigh-ins. I mean, why do we know, you know, what's that guy in Syndicate MMA here in Vegas? I know you know who I'm talking about. He always dresses up for every single weigh-in.
I know who you're talking about. I just can't think of his name right now. Is it Tom Lawler?
Tom Lawler, exactly. So we know this guy because of his crazy weigh-ins, and that's absolutely great promotion for him. And, you know, I think the UFC should let these guys have a little bit more personality. And, you know, who did we see this past weekend get inducted into the Hall of Fame? Sakuraba. I mean, this guy was the showman of all showmen, and everybody knows him, you know, both inside and outside the ring. So I think they need to be a little bit more lax on letting these guys build themselves. As long as they're following protocol, and I don't think, you know, a mask is really that much outside of protocol.
Yeah, you know, I totally get it that maybe you don't want them coming out there showing another company stuff, a competitor's logo or something of that nature. Okay, I totally get that. But to say that I can't wear a Marvel comic book's character's mask, the same Marvel comic book that we can watch the movie for. In fact, the UFC, they allow movie, you know, this show, this event is brought to you by this movie in theaters July 14th.
Yeah, do you remember the UFC 181 poster? It was actually a comic book poster for the pay-per-view of UFC 181. I mean, that was sponsored by Marvel. So,
yeah, I totally don't understand it. And then most recently, you had Amanda Nunes wear the Lioness mask against Ronda Rousey. I don't know. Maybe, look, Are they so upset that Rousey lost? They don't want anyone to wear a mask? Because Nunes wore her Lioness mask, and that was so awesome because it was badass. She had a post-fight weigh-in, I mean, at the post-fight press conference, but not allowing Angela Hill to wear this, I thought it was completely bogus on their part. So the UFC really needs to get their act together in that regard. You want these fighters to show personality, but you're limiting when and where they can show their personality. Now, Leo, you brought it up earlier, so I'm going to let you get into it right now. The UFC Hall of Fame took place. Definitely wasn't the crowd we were hoping it was, but let's talk about the UFC Hall of Fame. You know, Maurice Smith got inducted, Joe Silva got inducted, Yoel Faber and Sakuraba got inducted. Just talk about the experience of being at the Hall of Fame and the fighters who got inducted.
Yeah, like you said, MMA fandom was a little bit tepid this past weekend. There wasn't a whole lot of noise going on for this quote-unquote big weekend of the UFC. You know, they had to tarp off a lot of the seats for the weigh-ins and for the workouts. So, you know, the fanhood just really wasn't there like it has been for past events. But as far as the event itself went. I thought it was very entertaining. I loved going to the UFC Hall of Fame and watching, you know, Don Frye was absolutely hysterical. You know, he was hitting on Misha Tate. He told excellent stories. I think this guy is a person that they really need to bring back more and let the fans interact and see him more, because a lot of people don't know who Don Frye is. But now we got to see a little bit more from him. And, you know, people have forgotten how entertaining this guy can be. So I absolutely loved Sakuraba getting inducted in the Hall of Fame. Joe Silva had a really good speech. I mean, it was just a really, really fun weekend. Unfortunately, there was just not a lot of people that would enjoy it.
Nah, definitely. We were there in person, and, you know, I'll just say it. We were in the upper deck, and we were told after 7:30 when the event was supposed to start, that we could all move down. Because they didn't have enough bodies there to fill up the front row seats. And it's unfortunate, because I do believe that the UFC is trying to do a better job with their Hall of Fame. They had it in Park Theater, which was a very nice theater, by the way. That was the first time I've ever been there. Very wonderful looking theater, very nice setup. And they're trying to make it, you know, normally when me and you have gone before, they had the Hall of Fame during the fan expo. So it was like another event at the expo, which was nice, but it kind of didn't make it feel like that much special. This one, it felt special. It's its own event. The guys are dressed up. It's in the theater. It's separate from everything else. So it felt more special, which I think is correct because of what these men and future women have meant to the sport of mixed martial arts. So I like the idea of that. But good gosh, not having the crowd there to support it and to show the numbers, that's why I think the UFC is going to have its trouble. And I ask you this. Yoel Faber just returned recently, and he's already inducted into the Hall of Fame. Should there be a wait period for these fighters being inducted? Because, yes, Yoel Faber is a Hall of Famer, but it doesn't feel special that we just saw you retire a couple of months ago, and now we're seeing you in the Hall of Fame. You know, with Sakuraba, it felt special because it's like, oh, my God, Sakuraba, it's been years, and now he's here. Maurice Smith, close to 20 years since he's been in the UFC, since he won the UFC tournament, when he became the first striker base fighter to win the UFC tournament, that it feels more special. Do you think there should be a wait period for when fighters or people involved should get inducted into the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, it was kind of bizarre how they mentioned it. You know, Uriah, we've kind of kept an eye on him for the last few months. We know exactly where he is, so it's not like we've been missing our dose of Uriah, and now he gets inducted into the Hall of Fame, and now it's a special moment for him. I mean, like I said, we've known exactly where he's been, so it didn't feel like as special of a moment. And I don't know if you caught this, but he didn't necessarily close the doors on retirement completely. You know, he said, maybe at some point I'll get the itch back again. So now it's just going to be another Hall of Famer fighting in the cage again. I mean, we've seen BJ Penn fight as a Hall of Famer. I think Chuck Liddell fought as a Hall of Famer, and maybe Tito. So, yeah, I think you're right. There should be a longer wait time before these guys get inducted in the Hall of Fame to know that they're 100% retired before they pull the trigger on this kind of thing. So maybe one thing I did like about the ceremony is that now they split the Hall of Fame into sections. So now they have a wing for contributors, a wing for pioneers like Sakuraba, and a wing for like the modern era of MMA, which is Urai Faber. Maybe that was their next guy that they wanted to feature in the modern wing. Maybe that's, you know, the closest guy that's recently retired, so that they could show off that there's a modern wing of MMA fighters.
Nah, definitely, sir. I do like the separation because it does allow for you to not only understand what these fighters are being inducted for and the meaning of what of their careers, but it certainly allows for you to say, okay, let's make sure we recognize X amount of people. Now, one thing I do hope the UFC does not do, the UFC does not have a rich history to fall back on. The NFL is still inducting guys from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. The NBA is still inducting guys from that era as well. Baseball, same thing. The UFC doesn't have that long history, so what I hope that they don't do is I hope they don't try to rush guys in there so quickly just for the need of filling up spots. There are still plenty of older fighters like Frank Shamrock, Pat Miletich, who haven't been inducted yet, who need to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. And I would say this, I don't think you need a representative from each wing every year, because when you do that, you're going to start running out of people quick when you've only been around for, 24 years? They might end up being like the WWE Hall of Fame, where after a certain time, they're kind of promoting guys into the Hall of Fame who realistically shouldn't be there, but you're trying to fill a number. So I definitely think that they shouldn't try to rush guys in there, but it is good to see that they are trying to make the U.S. special and make an actual event itself. Leo,
listen, I'll just be really happy if the UFC just, they gather their thoughts and just go ahead and induct Pete Rose into the UFC Hall of Fame, and that would have to be into the modern wing of the UFC Hall of Fame.
Well, I mean, let's be fair. He is one of the greatest hitters of all time, so I'm pretty sure Pete Rose, he could have did something in the UFC with that hard slap style. Who knows? He probably would have gambled on his own.
If he made
fight.
It to the WWE Hall of Fame, then he certainly belongs in the UFC Hall of Fame.
That is true. That is true. But I will say, Pete Rose, even though he doesn't deserve to be in there, at least he was entertaining during his time in the WWE when he was around. So, but that is a good one. Now, International Fight Week, Leo, me and you have been to it before, and we have seen what it was like before when it was a major deal before Reebok came in. And this year, it wasn't at the Las Vegas Convention Center. It wasn't really at any convention center. It was outside the T-Mobile Arena in a tent. Now, they did have fighters on the inside in the lobby of T-Mobile Arena signing autographs, but I believe that it was only, 300 fans allowed to come in either at a time or just total, and then that was it. Then they had a big tent outside, and Leo, it's July in Las Vegas. Is the UFC crazy? Thinking, oh, yeah, we'll just have a tent outside. The fans will come out. I don't know if you saw the pictures. There wasn't a lot of fans there waiting in line to go there. What has been wrong with International Fight Week? Where's the UFC missing a boat at here?
I think, these WME guys are trying to rebuild their brand as their own. And one thing that we did see this past weekend that was a welcome change was that everything was free. So, you didn't have to pay for a UFC Fan Expo experience. You just go out there and line up outside, unfortunately outside. So maybe because they weren't charging for admission, they didn't really feel the need to rent out an expo center or anything like that. So maybe they were just kind of trying to save a couple pennies there. But I mean, if the UFC Fan Expo is going to be free, from now on, then I guess that's something that we can kind of deal with. I think their big mistake was that they didn't really promote anything. I don't remember seeing much of anything in UFC pay-per-views or even the free cards that, hey, guys, if you're going to be in Vegas this weekend, come in and meet all the fighters for free. And I didn't see any of that. There was really no promotion. There was no commercials, no billboards here in Vegas. There was nothing. So maybe the reason fans didn't really show up. I mean, yeah, there is no big name. There's no Ronda. There's no Conor. But maybe people just didn't know that this thing was going on.
Now, certainly, you're in Vegas, we didn't even see any promotion going on for it, and that's pretty sad, especially considering that it's supposed to be quote-unquote their Super Bowl week for the most part. WME, maybe because of their first year, they're just trying to see what works, what doesn't. Hey, if we do it here, let's see how it turns out. But, it wasn't the buzz that we are used to out here. Maybe next year it will be. And granted, you know, there's no Brock Lesnar, no Jon Jones, no McGregor, no Ronda Rousey out here. So, you know, I understand that maybe because of the lack of stars, and that could also be on them not building up stars correctly, you know, the buzz just wasn't needed. Now, what do you think about this idea that the UFC might be trying to make Southern California their new base of operations, as far as that's where they want their events to be? Will we see the UFC? Granted, they're still going to be in Vegas, but are they going to try to start doing expos and big events and whatnot in Southern California? I mean, WMING is an entertainment agency. Are they going to try to get that Hollywood connection? And hey, we want this to be like a Hollywood theme. What do you think about that notion?
I don't think that would be in their best interest. You know, what they do with the headquarters, that's up to them. But, you know, now they have this big investment in this big UFC gym that opened recently, you know, that all the fighters are welcome. You know, they have medical staff, and they have cooks, and they have all this crazy equipment open to the fighters. They just inaugurated that building, you know, a few months ago. And, you know, they already have, you know, all these contracts with T-Mobile Arena and, I mean, that's just Las Vegas. Like Dana White has said over the years, Las Vegas is like the fight capital of the world. This is where the big events come, and people are willing to travel because this is a world destination. So, you know, I think the structure is already set up for big fights to happen here in Las Vegas. And I don't think it would be in the best business interest to really move those big, huge events out of Las Vegas. You know, the hotels are already all in one place. Everything's a walking distance from each other. You know, like, there are enough hotel rooms to fit, you know, 40,000-50,000 people that are coming in for such events. So I don't really see them, and I really hope they don't take the big marquee fights out of Las Vegas, because I think this is the place where it makes the most sense.
Nah, definitely. I definitely hope that they don't do it. I mean, this is right in our backyard, so I definitely hope that doesn't happen, but we'll see how it goes going forward. Now, That International Fight Week, a lot in just a couple of days, but hey, International Fight Week, that's what it gives you. But some other news outside of this, outside of International Fight Week, former UFC heavyweight champion Frank Mir got released from the UFC. Now, Frank was serving a suspension, popping hot under USADA. He claims it was a tainted kangaroo meat, and, you know, and he was going to fight it. Now, you know, again, we've seen some fighters come up hot for things that weren't necessarily there. Leo, I don't know if you noticed. You know, if you drink coffee too close to the test, you could pop hot. You know, and that's just coffee. All of us get coffee. So,
right.
You know, it's a lot of things that people don't realize that are very simple, everyday products we use for different things that we can pop hot for. So, you know, the idea of, oh, well, you were trying to get, you know, Mexican supplements or take, you know, a shot in the ass, that's not always the case. But Frank Mir now is a free agent, and he says, hey, he still wants to fight. Maybe Bellator is a good place to sign him. Ryzen, possibly. World Series of Fighting, we'll see. But he put out the notion that he's looking forward to maybe facing Fedor. Frank Mir offered to fight Fedor before Fedor was linked to come, but he also threw out his number one adversary, the man who he's tied up with at 1-1, settle the match. Frank Mir, Brock Lesnar, 3. What do you think? Should we see that match? And if so, how awesome would it be?
I mean, would it really be surprising to see Scott Coker try to land a fight like that? I mean, that's just got Scott Coker written all over it. I don't know that Brock Lesnar is under any sort of contract with the UFC. Maybe that they would try to step in on something like that. You know, if Brock Lesnar wants to fight in MMA, I think he wants to fight the best in the world, and he would go into the UFC. But you never know with somebody as wily as Scott Coker, who's just, I mean, this guy is the epitome of making the fights that people want to see, and also making some fights that people don't want to see, like Ken Shamrock and whatnot. But more often than not, I think, you know, Scott Coker is a very, very good guy at building brands, and now he's got a big name in Frank Mir to, you know, at his reach. So I think he's going to make a really big star out of Frank Mir at Spike TV once again. So, I mean, there's a lot of guys out there. You know, he's got history with Chuck Congo. There's Matt Mitrione out there waiting for him. Maybe Fedor. Maybe Chael Sonnen. I mean, there's fights out there for for Frank Mir, and he's a very well-spoken, entertaining guy, a fan favorite. I think this is a home run for Scott Coker if he manages to sign Frank Mir.
I would think that Bellator needs to make sure that they sign him to beef up their heavyweight division, especially with Fedor losing so quickly to Matt Mitrione. You want to get some guys in there to be credible and give you some names. You don't, unfortunately, you don't have Kimbo Slice anymore. Shamrock obviously wasn't a long-term solution, and Dada 5000, well, I mean, I think the name speaks for itself. That wasn't be anything long-term either. So you want to get some couple guys in there. And Frank Mir is still young enough to give you a couple good years left on fight in a fight game. And Brock Lesnar was only under a one-fight deal with the UFC. So even though he would want to fight, it was only a one-time deal. And considering what happened with USADA, who knows? If Bellator is willing to come out and throw enough money at him, you know, and say, hey, we'll do another pay-per-view, you and Frank Mir for the third time, let's see. Who knows? Brock may consider doing another round in MMA. That would be pretty awesome. Now, another guy who is in Bellator is Gegard Mousasi. He was a free agent, said he wanted to stay in the UFC, but the money just wasn't right. Now he is signed with Bellator, and he has said the middleweight division needs to be put on notice. Gegard has fought at light heavyweight and in heavyweight. What do you think about Bellator adding such a tremendous fighter in Gegard Mousasi?
So I think this story is slightly different than the one of Frank Mir, because, you know, Frank Mir is towards the tail end of his career. You know, he's kind of just looking for, you know, a last number of fights to really, you know, get him going and you know, keep his career moving forward. Man, Gegard Mousasi is at the top of his game right now, and he's in a very, very good division at 185 in the UFC. Selfishly, I'm really sad to see him go. I really wanted to see some of these fights happen in the UFC. I think he's a possible champion in any organization. So I'm kind of sad to see Mousasi go to Bellator. But at the same time, Scott Coker, I mean, he's an absolute genius at matchmaking these guys. And there's a lot of fights out there for him as well. I mean, there's Rory McDonald out there. I think you go ahead and give Gegard Mousasi an immediate title shot at middleweight. So, I mean, that's a great, great signing for them. I think the UFC kind of messed up by letting him go.
Yeah, I think the UFC kind of dropped the ball here. The middleweight division is stacked, but, you know, Yoel Romero's 40 years old. Anderson is over 40 years old. Dan Henderson just retired. Bisping's talking about retiring. Weidman, you know, health-wise, he might retire or move to light heavyweight. And they're going to need bodies in that that middleweight division to keep it going. So, Mousasi, though, going to Bellator. And look, Bellator, obviously, is Strikeforce 2.0. But, look, at first, we thought it was a joke. Okay, they got T. Ortiz. They got Chael Sonnen. Okay, cool. Now, you're getting Gegard Mousasi. You took Phil Davis and Ryan Bader, two young guys who may not have been champions in UFC, but were still in their prime of their careers, three young bodies for the division. They got Rory McDonald. They got Benson Henderson. They started especially with the Reebok deal and how guys are promoted correctly there. Bellator is really going to start giving you guys a push for their money going forward. So it's going to be interesting to see how it goes from there. Another great show as always, Leo, man. Great to have you on here, man. Great to to share this knowledge with you and to share it with everybody. Go ahead, give us your final quick thought. We got about 80 seconds left. Give us your final quick thought and let people know where they can find you out on social media.
Yeah, just once again, regarding the UFC Hall of Fame, it was an absolute honor to sit, you know, just a few feet from Sakuraba. I was absolutely delighted to see him, you know, have a big moment. It was very funny in his speech. He said this is the first thing he's won since some bingo tournament some months ago. So I was really happy to see a guy like that get recognized. So, hey, more power to the Gracie Killer himself. And, yeah, so follow me at Shower Leo on Twitter.
There you go, brother. Definitely, indeed. Sakuraba was nice. Hey, you know what? For International Fight Week, it could be a lot better. Hopefully the UFC gets it right going forward, but it is what it is. Follow me on Twitter at KLU11, KLUA11. Also, follow my sports page, All Things Sports, on Facebook. That is All Things Sports on Facebook. Until next week, everybody, take care and peace.
Start it.
Johnny on the track.
Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team fucking here. Started from the bottom, now we here.